Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this glorious day. We offer ourselves to you and pray that you may make this time a joy and an encouragement to us. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, thank you for being here. It's fascinating. I know there are so many offerings in the afternoons that it's challenging to get people out to talk about literature. And even with the person of Shakespeare, I dare say we'll have more when we talk about Harry Potter on Wednesday. Though there isn't a great deal of comparison in quality, but I like Harry Potter. But we're going to talk in this about Shakespeare. I'm going to follow the outline you have in front of you just a little bit, though there will be many other things I want to say that aren't in that outline. So I would just glance at it, and I will be using some of the quotations you've got there as we go along. Shakespeare was the person of the last millennium. If you remember the surveys that were done around the turn of the year 2000, they included people who were in politics, in literature, in every walk of life, in every kind of the arts, in every field of human endeavor. And no matter how people asked the question, Shakespeare came out with twice as many votes as anybody else by very far, even including people like Karl Marx, in terms of the most influential person of the last millennium. And obviously there are five of you here at least who think that that's true, so that's nice to be here together. Now, I'm sure, simply because you're here, you will have probably seen some of his plays on the stage, either in English or in translation, because certainly he's the most popular playwright who has written in any language on the face of this earth at any point in human history. You've also probably seen some of the films that have been made over the past few years. The ones that were particularly popular were Henry V, which was nominated for the best film in the Oscars the year it came out. Much Ado About Nothing, both of those produced by Kenneth Branagh, and with him and Emma Thompson in the primary roles. Also his wonderful film of Hamlet, one of the rare full-length productions of it, which one hardly ever sees. And also there was a wonderful production of Twelfth Night. But many of his films have been made into plays for popular release as well as for television over the past few years. One of the fascinating things about Shakespeare is that he was a very private man. So almost nothing is known about his personal life. And that reality has given rise to endless speculation. As you're probably aware, people have speculated that all sorts of other people wrote his plays rather than the human being called William Shakespeare, from the King of England to all sorts of other people, committees of people, and many other suggestions, Francis Bacon, etc. But there is no reason to believe that at all, that it wasn't this man, William Shakespeare. It's certain that he did indeed write these plays. But he's not a man who tells us a lot about his personal life. Even in his sonnets, which are obviously very personal and very beautiful, we can't really learn a great deal about him in terms of what was going on in his mind and heart. Shakespeare, we could say, was a man of many parts. He was an actor. He went to London, in fact, to become an actor from his home up in Stratford-on-Avon. And he would take part regularly in the plays that were being performed, as well as at the same time that he was acting, let's say, as the ghost in Hamlet. That was one of the parts that he took. He would also be writing new plays at the same time that he was acting every day in the repertory theatre company of which he was a part. So he was an actor. He was also a very sensible and successful businessman. He was the part owner of the theatre company in which his plays were performed and in which he acted. His fellow actors were a group of 8 men, 2 or 3 boys who would play the parts of women, because women weren't on the stage at that time in history. And then they would hire extras for plays in which they needed a few more people. But with a small company like that, it meant all of them were taking usually 2 or 3 parts in the plays in which they acted. But he was a part owner of this theater company. It built its own theater, and I'm sure you've seen drawings at least of maybe even some of the actual reconstructions that have been made in various places around the world, where people have built copies of the theater that Shakespeare and his fellows built. But they had an interesting year in terms of their productions. They would play each season before the court of Queen Elizabeth and then King James. And that those plays would go from December the 12th, 26th, the night after Christmas, Boxing Day in England, till Twelfth Night. And of course, the play Twelfth Night was written for one of those occasions. So for a couple of weeks every winter, they were performing for the Queen and for her household. They would have another brief season before the Queen in at the time of Lent, just a couple of a week or so at that point. In the Christmas season, they do 4 or 5 plays for the Queen and her court. At Lent, maybe 2 or 3. In addition to those brief periods acting before the court, they had a season in London every spring and every autumn, a fairly extensive season, and a very busy season. They would perform a different play each afternoon of the week. So, you know, 5 plays basically running at once. Think of all the lines that meant learning for people taking a couple of parts in each of these plays. And then every 2 weeks they would drop one and introduce another play. So working like a typical repertory company today, but actually acting even more plays than would be the norm in most repertory theatres at this time. During the summer, they would leave London because that was the plague season. It wasn't a sensible place to stay in the summer. And they would go out and perform plays all over the country. So they were acting out around the country during the summer. So that was kind of how their seasons went. So Shakespeare was an actor. He was a part owner of a theater company, an entrepreneur, we might say, and eventually became very prosperous as a consequence of this, and retired in 1612 to back to Stratford, to his hometown. In addition, of course, he's a poet, one of the greatest poets to have written in the English language. And I've given you some examples here that you can take away with you. And just draw your attention to one or two of these. I think on the top page you have there, anybody who doesn't have a copy, I've got some extra ones here. Just pass them. This is a very famous set of lines from his play Antony and Cleopatra. And what's taking place in this particular scene is that Enobarbus, a general who served Mark Antony, one of his most devoted followers, is describing how Mark Antony, who was at the time married to Octavia, the sister of the man who would later become Caesar Augustus, the emperor at the time of the birth of Christ. Mark Antony falls in love with Cleopatra and begins to live, to have an affair with her, which leads, among other things, one of the causes of the civil war that happened between the triumvirate that were governing Rome and its empire at that time. Adina Barbas is describing in this scene the first time that Antony met Cleopatra in the most extraordinary words, which I don't read this poetry really well, but as I read it and as you listen, as you look at it, you can see some of the things that he is doing here in terms of the beauty of what he's describing and the way he captures it, the sensuality of it, the scent of it, the sight, what it is about Cleopatra that enraptures Antony. I will tell you, the barge she sat in, like a burnished throne burned on the water. The poop was beaten gold, purple the sails, and so perfumed that the winds were lovesick with them. The oars were silver, which the tune of flutes kept stroke and made the water which they beat to follow faster as amorous of their strokes. For her own person, it beggared all description. She did lie in her pavilion, cloth of gold, of tissue, or picturing that Venus where we see that fancy outwork nature. On each side her stood pretty dimpled boys like smiling cupids with divers colored fans whose wind did seem to glow the delicate cheeks which they did cool and what they undid did. Her gentlewomen, like the Nereides, so many mermaids, tended her in the eyes and made their bends adornings. At the helm, a seeming mermaid steers. The silken tackle swell with the touches of those flower-soft hands that yearly frame the office. From the barge, a strange, invisible perfume hits the sense of the adjacent wharfs. The city cast her people out upon her, and Antony, enthroned in the marketplace, did sit alone, whistling to the air, which but for vacancy had gone to gaze on Cleopatra too, and made a gap in nature. It's just one lovely example of Shakespeare's ability with words. If you turn over the page, you'll see an example from Hamlet. As I'm sure you're aware, there are some of the greatest poetic soliloquies that have ever been written in this play, with Hamlet reflecting on the brokenness of the human condition and the tragedy of his life. And here he is soliloquizing on his discovery of his mother's basic betrayal of his father when she marries his brother after he's murdered. Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew, or that the everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter. Oh, God, God, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seems to me all the uses of this world. Fie on it, fie, it is an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. That it should come to this. But 2 months dead, nay, not so much, not two, so excellent a king that was to this Hyperion to a satyr, so loving to my mother that he might not beteem the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. Heaven and earth must I remember? Why she would hang on him, as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on, and yet within a month, let me not think on it. Frailty, thy name is woman. A little month, or ere those shoes were old with which she followed my poor father's body like Niobe, all tears, why she, even she, O God, a beast, that once discourse of reason would have mourned longer, married with my uncle, my father's brother, but no more like my father than I to Hercules. Within a month, yet the salt of most unrighteous tears had left the flushing in her galled eyes, she married. Oh, most wicked speed to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets. It is not, nor it cannot come to good. But break my heart, for I must hold my tongue. So those are just two examples, and I've given you some more you can take home with you and go and stand out somewhere and read aloud, because you need to read poetry aloud to enjoy it. I would encourage you to do that. And then if you haven't read a lot of Shakespeare, start reading some more and read it aloud to yourself. So he's a great poet, and also so an actor, a theater company owner, a poet, and a playwright. And I think there's very little question but that he was the greatest playwright that the human race has yet produced in any language. Certainly there is no playwright in the history of the world whose plays we still have, that whose plays are performed so frequently in so many countries all over the world, every single day that we live. There are Shakespeare plays being performed in many nations around the world, over and over and over again, not simply in English, but in translation. And of course, it takes very good drama to take to translation. It also tells us something about how well Shakespeare deals with the human condition, that you can translate his plays into many different languages and they are immensely popular wherever they are performed. He wasn't writing simply about some English scene, which was private and unrelated to the rest of human life, but about the issues which confront all human beings at every point in human history. He wrote 36 or 37 plays. I say that because there's a question about one or two of them as to whether he was fully the author of them. Now, what Shakespeare did in theatre was basically new. There were, of course, good plays before Shakespeare, but he really takes the theatre in a new direction. The only person who does anything at all similar before his time is Christopher Marlowe, who is a contemporary of his and who dies as a young man in a pub brawl in London, knifed to death. And there's all sorts of speculation about that, of course, as well. Marlowe wrote a handful of plays, which are some of which are quite good, particularly Faustus and a couple of the others. But nothing like the accomplishment of Shakespeare. So Shakespeare comes on the scene and he immediately begins to take theatre to a whole new level, not only in the English language, but really in any language, in terms of what he accomplishes just in the brief time in which he writes all these plays, basically between around 1590 and 1612. That's the time when he is producing this great body of work. Now, one of the things that is fascinating about Shakespeare's plays is this. Because he is such a great writer, such a great playwright, every speech in his plays, from whatever perspective it comes, is powerful and persuasive. It's one of the fascinating things that whether you're reading King Lear, for example, which is a very bleak play, and in some ways very appropriate for a postmodern times because of its bleakness about the human condition. Whatever perspective his characters are speaking from, he speaks with such extraordinary power that these speeches are persuasive. Now, this is one of the reasons why it's very difficult to know what Shakespeare personally thought about anything, because he presents so many different and contradictory positions so very well in the persons of the characters in all these plays, the good and the evil, all speak with extraordinary power and clarity and persuasion. You might say that Shakespeare is the writer with 1,000 faces. As many characters as there are well developed in his plays, you have this many points of view that come across. As a playwright, he took material to work on from a great diversity of sources. There are plays which are based on material from the ancient world of Greece and of Rome, plays from many different parts of Europe during the Middle Ages and up to his own time, and plays, of course, from the history of Britain and also from the legends of Britain. Because of this great diversity, both of sources, material, and perspectives which are presented in his plays, people have, interpreters have, critics have, found a vast variety of different perspectives in his plays. If any of you, for example, have seen more than one production of Hamlet, you will have probably seen radically different views of what Hamlet's problem was. Hamlet is the classic example of this, of critics bringing really their own prejudices to the play, or producers bringing their own prejudices to the play and imposing them on them. There's a wonderful essay about this, about the history of Hamlet interpretation, which is absolutely fascinating. But different productions of Hamlet will make Hamlet a hero, a villain, a madman, a romantic, a woman hater, a misogynist, an incestuous man who is in love with his mother, an existentialist, whatever you like. People find all these different perspectives in Hamlet, and each different production you will see will often have these radically different kinds of approaches to him. It's rare to find a production of Hamlet which basically lets the play speak for itself, and I think that's one of the beauties about Kenneth Branagh's production. It's in giving the whole play, some of the producers are able to present their particular perspective by leaving great chunks of the play out, which would, because altogether it's well over 4 hours if you have the whole thing in there. But if you leave bits out, of course, it's possible to twist it somewhat. But that film production of Kenneth Branagh's, if you haven't seen it, certainly in terms of the productions I've seen, and I must have seen a dozen or more on the stage and on film, is the one, I think, which perhaps most faithfully represents the play as Shakespeare actually wrote it, and the character of Hamlet as Shakespeare, I believe, presents him. Now, having said this, that people find many, many different views in Shakespeare, many different positions, it's my very deep conviction that Shakespeare was a Christian, and that a biblical worldview pervades all that he writes. I have the delight, the seminary gives me the freedom, though my primary task is teaching apologetics, for I teach in St. Louis. The seminary gives me the freedom to teach classes on literature, so every now and again I teach a class on Shakespeare, which is a great deal of fun. And the more I read of Shakespeare and the more I reflect upon him, the more I am persuaded that he was indeed basically presenting a biblical worldview in his plays. I'll just give you some examples here. Henry V is a fascinating example. He actually describes, Henry V is presented as the mirror of Christian kings. That's one of the ways he is described. And the play then expresses that in all sorts of ways. The brother of his soldiers, a man committed to justice and mercy, and many, many other issues like this. It's a very careful reflection on what the Bible has to say about the nature of leadership which is pleasing to God. And this is brought out repeatedly during the course of the play. That's one example. Another example is in Measure for Measure, which is, I think, one of the most interesting and most powerful studies of the abuse of human authority that anybody has ever written. It's a study of the nature of law and of authority in the offices of government, and how that ruling authority can be corrupted by legalism, by the attitude of the Pharisee. That's one of the things that Measure for Measure is about. How Angelo, who has the heart of a Pharisee, comes to power and then resurrects many laws that are dead on the books of the city where he governs, and starts doing just terrible things all over the place. It's also a play which is a deep and very careful reflection on justice and mercy. What is the nature of true justice? And the necessity of those in authority exercising mercy, and Angelo's abysmal failure to do that, even though he has had wonderful examples of it before him. And it's a play about redemption, about how mercy leads to redemption. And it has some very beautiful statements in it about the work of Christ. And so the whole issue of law, of justice, of mercy, of redemption is related to the gospel at the very heart of this play. That's Measure for Measure. And of course, the title itself is taken from Jesus' words, that the measure you give will be the measure you get. And that's the theme of the play, because Angelo is giving a certain measure to people. In the end, he doesn't actually get it. He gets mercy instead, which is wonderful, of course. Or take the example of Hamlet. Hamlet, I think, if you give the play, allow the play to speak for itself rather than imposing, let's say, a postmodern or an existentialist or a humanist or a misogynist or whatever kind of vision you like on it, but actually let it speak for itself. Hamlet is a play about a man who is confronted with appalling evil. What has taken place is his beloved father's murder by his father's own brother, fratricide, a particularly horrible crime, worse than any ordinary murder within the bounds of a family, a murder which is simply for the furtherance of this man's own ambition. So he takes Hamlet's father's crown and kingdom, and he takes his wife as well. And Hamlet, the son, who rightfully should be the king when his father dies, is confronted with this abominable situation. And he becomes so overwhelmed by the reality of evil, by this wickedness, that his will becomes paralyzed as he confronts the reality of human frailty and of how close beneath the surface of our lives, beneath the surface of our glory, lies the shame of our wickedness and of our ruin. And it's a very fascinating play in that way. There are some of the most marvelous statements in any English poetry and in any English drama about the glory of human persons, as we are made in the image of God. But there are also some of the most powerful statements of our shame as those who have turned away from God's commandments and live in rebellion and disobedience. Now, that's Hamlet. Again, I think it is a play which is speaking from a very deeply Christian perspective. I want to turn and say a little bit more about Macbeth and use that as my primary example of a play which shows Shakespeare reflecting on human life from a thoroughly biblical perspective. The play itself is basically a reflection on the problem of evil, on the nature of evil in the human heart and its consequences. Now, there are a couple of issues I want to address here, and you'll see these in your outline there. First is the interaction of the supernatural world of demons and of witchcraft, the world of the occult, with our world. Now, when we read the script of Macbeth, or if we watch a production, there are various ways the play is understood. And the question, of course, is which is Shakespeare's, which is faithful to his vision? The first example is you'll see many contemporary productions which present the supernatural as not real at all. The witches are just a figment of Macbeth's imagination. Or they get turned into some kind of joke, which they most certainly aren't, in the play itself. So I've seen productions both on the stage and in film in which the supernatural is presented as not real. And so that whole element of the play gets kind of pushed into the background and is seen as just simply a psychological phenomenon in Macbeth's mind. Now that, I think there's no question whatsoever that that certainly wasn't Shakespeare's view. And we'll talk about this a little bit as we go along here. A second alternative is what we see in the film made by Roman Polanski. Some of you will be familiar with the work of Polanski, the Polish filmmaker, an extraordinarily fine filmmaker, and he made a quite remarkable production of Hamlet, I suppose, 20 years ago now, something like that, maybe even in the late 60s. I don't remember exactly when it was made, or early 70s. But in that play, you might say that Polanski overdoes the reality of demonic evil. Polanski's version presents the world of the demonic completely controlling human events. This is made very, very clear that the play begins with, in Polanski's version, with Hamlet and Banquo riding along a road, and a tremendous storm breaks out of extraordinary power, and they have to take shelter. The place where they take shelter is the place where they hear the witches singing. And they go to find out what the noise is. And then they hear the witches making these prophecies, the prophecy of Macbeth becoming thane of Glamis of Cawdor and ultimately king, and also the prophecy that Banquo's descendants will be kings in a great long line on the throne of Scotland, and eventually of Britain. Now, the way Polanski presents that is that basically the events are controlled by this demonic happening at the beginning. And Macbeth is seen as a kind of puppet in the hands of these supernatural forces. And the witches are presented in the most terrible reality in terms of the evil. But Polanski does something else, as well as terrible scenes of wickedness in the film, which of course are in one sense quite accurate to the play, because it is a play about terrible human wickedness, though he certainly puts it, you might say, stage center with extraordinary power. At the very end of the play, at the end of his version of the play, there is a scene which doesn't appear in the play at all. You see the next king of Scotland and his brother, Malcolm, and his brother, Donal Bain, riding along the same road where the film starts. And again, there's an extraordinary thunderstorm and shower of rain, so they have to take shelter in exactly the same spot, and they hear the witches singing, and they are attracted to go down to hear them. Now, that's not in the play at all. But what Polanski presents is this view of human beings just controlled by these demonic forces. Now, in one way, one might say this is understandable, even though it's not what the play is about, as Shakespeare wrote it. In one way, it's understandable because Polanski made his production of the play just within a year or so after his own wife was murdered when she was pregnant in Los Angeles by Charles Manson and his group, a crime for which he is still in prison in the States, along with the people who did it with him. So he had, and Manson himself, without any question, was somebody who was subject to demonic power. There's no question about that whatsoever. So one can understand why Polanski did this, because he'd experienced the reality of supernatural evil and its impact on human beings in his own life in the most abominable way. But even having said that, what he does is not fair to the play as Shakespeare wrote it. That brings us to a third alternative, and it seems to me that this is the view that quite clearly is presented in the play itself. And that is that there is an interaction between the evil supernatural powers, the demonic powers, who use lies and deceit to try to take captive human souls. There's that reality, the reality of the evil supernatural. But Shakespeare also presents the human persons as significant, people as significant and truly responsible as being history makers who can themselves resist evil. And that's something that that Polanski leaves out, that element of human significance. It's also, incidentally, I think, something that's left out in many, many productions over the last 30 or 40 years, because many productions of Shakespeare's tragedies see the tragedy as being a flaw in the person's character, a flaw over which they have no control. But that's really a Greek view of history. It isn't Shakespeare's one, and it certainly isn't a biblical one, but that's been a common way to understand the tragedies of Shakespeare, rather than to see people as actually significant. And if you do that with Macbeth, it takes really the heart out of the play, because the essence of the play is Macbeth's struggle with evil and giving into it. If you just say these are fatal flaws in people, you end up with taking away their glory as well as taking away their significance. And that's what happens in many productions of Shakespeare's tragedies. But if you look at the quotations you have at the back of your notes there, not the ones I just handed out to you, but the other set that came with the outline of the lecture. At the first one you've got there, where it says quotes from Macbeth, from Act 1, Scene 3, are some words of Banquo. And this is Banquo's response to the prophecies that the witches have made. And Banquo resists their lies, their deceit, and their temptation. He says, "But 'tis strange, and oftentimes to win us to our harm, the instruments of darkness tell us truths, win us with honest trifles, to betray us in deepest confident consequence." That's Banquo's response. So he doesn't doubt that there may be truth in the prophecy that is made, but he understands very clearly that demonic evil, that the occult, seeks to seduce human beings, and it's necessary to resist what they say. Macbeth, on the other hand, isn't prepared to take the consequent the view that Banquo takes. And these next words that you have there are from him. His response is to say, this supernatural soliciting cannot be ill, cannot be good. If ill, why hath it given me earnest of success, commencing in a truth? I am Thane of Cawdor. And here Macbeth is speaking to himself, rather than for public consumption. If good, why do I yield to that suggestion, whose horrid image doth unfix my hair and make my seated heart knock at my ribs against the use of nature? Present fears are less than horrible imaginings. My thought, whose murder yet is but fantastical, shakes so my single state of man that function is smothered in surmise and nothing is but what is not. Now, there's Macbeth already beginning to imagine what he may have to do to bring about the fulfillment of this prophecy. He's already reflecting on murder, the murder of the king. Banquo's resisting what the witches have said. Macbeth is giving into it. Down below, if you look further down, there's a wonderful speech from Lady Macbeth. If you just pass down past the Prince of Cumberland to the next one, this is Lady Macbeth speaking to her husband when he has written to her about what the witches have said. And her response immediately is to begin imagining what they can do to bring this about. And she's talking about Macbeth here. She says, "Yet I do fear thy nature. It is too full of the milk of human kindness to catch the nearest way. Thou wouldst be great, art not without ambition, but without the illness should attend it. What thou wouldst highly, that wouldst thou holily. Wouldst not play false, and yet wouldst wrongly win. Thou'dst have great glams, that which cries, thou must do it, if thou have it. And that which rather thou dost fear to do, than wishest should be undone. Hie thee hither, that I may pour my spirits in thine ear." Which, of course, is exactly what she does as soon as he comes home. She pushes him very strongly to the murder. And one of the most shocking things in the whole play is what she then says here. This is a prayer to the powers of evil to come and possess her, to enable her to do this terribly wicked thing of murdering her king, her kinsman. Well, he's Macbeth's king, Macbeth's kinsman, and he's their guest. You know, they're going to commit a murder which is against three sacred laws. Somebody they're taking to their own home, a relative, and a person they have promised to subject themselves to as their monarch. And it's quite an awful prayer that she prays. "Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here, and fill me from the crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood. Stop up the access and passage to remorse, that no compunctious visitings of nature shake my fell purpose, nor keep peace between the effect and it. Come to my woman's breasts and take my milk for gall, you murdering ministers, wherever in your sightless substances you wait on nature's mischief. Come, thick night, and pour thee in the dunnest smoke of hell, that my keen knife see not the wound it makes, nor heaven peep through the blanket of the dark to cry, hold, hold." Now, this is clearly Shakespeare's view that there is a terrible reality of the evil supernatural, But there is also a deep significance of human persons who may choose to either resist or to accept this supernatural soliciting. It's clearly Shakespeare's view in that play, and any production of the play which doesn't acknowledge that is going to be unsatisfactory in all sorts of ways. And many productions of Macbeth are particularly unsatisfactory because of this. The second issue is this, and I alluded to it briefly already, and that is that human significance is what creates real tragedy. Again, many modern productions lose the tragedy by presenting Macbeth as a puppet on the wheel of fate, or as someone with a personality flaw that makes him powerless to resist evil. The first view, of course, is what you get in Greek tragedy. In the great Greek tragedies, people are trapped by fate. If you read Oedipus, for example, there's nothing people can do to avoid their fate. No choice can be made to prevent tragedy happening because people's lives are subject to the fates. That's certainly not Shakespeare's view, though often modern productions will suggest that it is. The other alternative there is saying this person has a personality flaw which they can do nothing about, makes them powerless to resist evil. That certainly isn't Shakespeare's view either. This play, Macbeth, is the most extraordinary study of a descent into evil as real choices are made both by Macbeth and by Lady Macbeth. The play opens with Macbeth as a hero, with somebody who's just done some wonderful things, some deeds of great courage and valor, so that we may identify with him and see his good qualities. He's a person you like, you sympathize with as the play begins. And even to the very end of the play, Macbeth is given some of the most beautiful poetry in all of Shakespeare's plays in our language. Macbeth is given some of this most beautiful poetry to speak, presenting, even as he descends into evil, that there are these remnants of glory in this human person, and underlining the tragedy of his fall. And there are some examples, I think, on the other handout I gave you, of things which come later in the play. There's one on the third page in this handout I passed around, one from Macbeth, one from The Merchant of Venice, and one from The Tempest. This is on the extra handout rather than the one you got from the conference. This is his response to the news of Lady Macbeth's death. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps on this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools this way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sand and fury, signifying nothing. Those are some of the most famous lines in English poetry, which you will see repeated in all sorts of contexts over and over again by people often who have no idea even where they come from, but they are such powerful lines. There's another one which you don't have there, which I typed into my notes this afternoon from the play, and it comes after he's murdered the king, and he says this: "Had I but died an hour before this chance, I had lived a blessed time. For from this instant, there's nothing serious in mortality. All is but toys. Renown and grace is dead. The wine of life is drawn, and the mere lees is left, this vault to brag of." This is a real tragedy because here is a person who has ruined their own life as well as the lives of many, many other peoples. Now that brings me to the final point here, and then I'll just open this up for discussion. Point number three, the consequence of the choices that Macbeth and Lady Macbeth make present to us a fully orbed biblical understanding of evil. Schaeffer used to talk about the five-pointed curse, and we can the various consequences of the fall in Genesis chapter 3. And we may find those very easily, very readily in this play of Shakespeare's. The first consequence of any human evil is the loss of fellowship with God, the loss of one's eternal soul. And this is something that Macbeth speaks about over and over again in this play. And you have that there in your notes. On the about not the second handout I gave you, but the original one you had, it's after the lines which I read a little earlier, where Lady Macbeth cries for the spirits to come and possess her and unsex her. The next quote you have there is from Macbeth himself. And he's already reflecting on the way this is going to destroy his relationship with God. If it were done when 'tis done, then 'twere well it were done quickly. If the assassination could trammel up the consequences and catch with his surcease success, that but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all here, but here, upon this bank and shoal of time, we jump the life to come. But in these cases, we still have judgment here, that we but teach bloody instructions, which being taught return to plague the inventor. This even-handed justice commends the ingredients of our poisoned chalice to our own lips. Here, Macbeth is reflecting on the reality of God's wrath against sin, even in this life. Here, sin has its consequences. There's no escaping it. It's what Paul is writing about in Romans chapter 1, that the wrath of God is being revealed now against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. And Macbeth is commenting on that notion. And then in the next lines, he speaks about the judgment of God to come. His virtues, that's Duncan's virtues, the king's virtues, will plead like angels, trumpet-tongued against the deep damnation of his taking off, that is, of his murder. And then when Macbeth has done the murder, these lines a little down below, about a paragraph or two down, where it says, "One cried, God bless us." This is Macbeth describing the immediate consequence in his own heart and on his own tongue of this terrible murder of the king in his own home there, in Macbeth's own home. And there are these two servants that he's made drunk of the king. And they wake up when Macbeth is doing the murder. One cried, "God bless us," and "Amen," the other, as they had seen me with these hangman's hands, listening their fear. I could not say "Amen" when they did say "God bless us." And his wife responds, "Consider it not so deeply. But wherefore could not I pronounce amen? I had most need of blessing." And amen stuck in my throat. Macbeth knows, and again this is reflected on over and over again in the play, that he is now headed for judgment. Judgment in this life, judgment in the life to come. That he has destroyed fellowship with God. Secondly, You see both Macbeth and Lady Macbeth alienated from themselves. She responds to his words there in this way. She says, "These deeds must not be thought after these ways, so it will make us mad." And then Macbeth replies, "Methought I heard a voice cry, sleep no more. Macbeth does murder sleep." And again, these lines, here's this man saying these terrible things, but are some of the most beautiful lines, the best lines ever written about sleep. Extraordinary images in these next lines here. "Macbeth does murder sleep, the innocent sleep. Sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of care. The death of each day's life, sore labor's bath, balm of hurt minds, great nature's second course, chief nourisher in life's feast." The play presents him as somebody who can hardly sleep from this point onwards, because his own conscience is so plagued by what he has done. Another way to express this would be to say both he and Lady Macbeth lose dominion over their own life. They are no longer able to rule themselves even. And at the end, in fact, we see, of course, Lady Macbeth take her own life. At one point, Macbeth says about himself, "Oh, full of scorpions is my mind. Oh, full of scorpions is my mind." And he says, "Better be with the dead than on the torture of the mind to lie in restless ecstasy." At the end, just before Lady Macbeth herself dies, her doctor says this about her: "Infected minds to their death pillows will discharge their secrets. More needs she, the divine, that is a pastor, than the physician. God, God, forgive us all. Look after her, remove from her the means of all annoyance, and still keep eyes upon her." So there's the loss of dominion. There's, fourthly, the breakdown of relationships with others. Nobody can trust Macbeth, of course, after this happens. What we see in the castle when he becomes king is a complete breakdown of human relationships. Nobody is trustworthy. Everyone is afraid of him. His first murder leads to many more murders. For example, the killing of Macduff's wife and children, which in Polanski's film is presented in such a horrific way, and which I have no doubt that Polanski sought to kind of purge himself, perhaps, of the death of his own wife in the way he represents that. If you've read any accounts of the killing of Sharon Tate and the people with her, it's extraordinarily like watching that scene in the film. He kills Macduff's wife and children. He hires common criminals to kill Banquo, his dearest friend, and to attempt to kill his son, Fleance, who escapes. So Macbeth's relationships break down completely. At the end of the play, he is a person with his wife gone, with nobody who loves him, and nobody whom he loves. His whole life has become empty and full of brokenness. Number five here, because Macbeth is the king now, because he has authority, the whole of the realm of Scotland becomes racked with evil. Shakespeare has very clearly the view that is represented in Scripture. See, if we example read about the reign of King Manasseh, because of his wickedness, the whole nation becomes terribly corrupted. Jerusalem becomes filled with innocent blood from one end to the other. The whole land is a place of wickedness. And that's what happens in Scotland as a consequence of Macbeth's evil. One of the most interesting scenes in the play is the contrast when the son of Duncan goes to England to visit the court of King Edward the Confessor, who is presented as a godly man, as a genuinely Christian king. And the contrast is so dramatic between this complete breakdown of civil order in Scotland and what is reality is like in England at the time. And then finally, Shakespeare even presents disorder in the realm of nature as one of the direct consequences of Macbeth's evil act. There's this very powerful description of the sky becoming dark, of horses killing each other, of a small bird of prey killing a falcon, and other examples like this. Here is a world which becomes cursed because of human sin. So again, in this play, Shakespeare presents to us a fully biblical view, both of the reality of sin, how it comes about, and then its consequences in the lives of people in this world and in our relationship with God. I'll stop there, which is just perfect because the video just came to an end as well. Okay, any questions here? Yes, sir.
There is a sentence.
Okay.
So there is a sentence in Macbeth. I didn't find a quotation here where Macbeth says, I think I quote it right, that I'm destined to be evil, which is translated in Hungarian once, my destiny is to be evil. In another translation, I decided to be evil.
There's no statement exactly like that in the play, I think. After he has made the choice, in that context, he then speaks about his destiny, but that's rather different. It's not before he makes the choice. He talks about the impact now of what he's done, that he has no choice but to continue in the path that he has gone. He realizes that once he has gone down this path, it's going to lead to more and more evil, which is a thoroughly biblical sense. So he's not using destiny in the sense of I have no choice. What he's saying is that now I've chosen this path, the path itself keeps opening up before me into even further acts of wickedness. But the only way he could go back is to stand publicly open and say, I have been wicked. And would suffer the consequences, but he's not prepared to do that. And that's what he means by that. So he's not talking about destiny in the sense that there's nothing I can do about it. What he means is he's chosen his own destiny, and his destiny, for worse, is now this particular path, the path which is going to be a bloody path to the very end. That's the point that he's making.
So you can't... you can't... see an interpretation that connects it with the witches at the beginning, so he's referring back to the prophecy that I'm destined to be evil because
no,
of
I don't
the prophecy.
Think that's the point. I think in the context that I don't have it immediately in front of me, it'd take me a while to find that particular bit in the play. I've got the play here, but no, I think he's quite clearly talking about the path that he's chosen, which now has laid before him necessarily follows. It's just like any sin that we do. You lie once, Mm. It becomes much easier to lie the second time, and so on. And then to turn back becomes more and more difficult,
mm.
because you are fixing your character in a particular direction. It's one of the terrible things about our human significance, that we become shaped ourselves by the choices we make, and that's what he's reflecting on. Now for him now, turning back would be immediately to deliver himself unto judgment and to be put to death for his wickedness, and he's not prepared to do that.
Mm-hmm.
He's made this choice and he's going to live with it. But it's like him saying, I've made my bed, I'm going to lie on it. This is the destiny before me right now.
And another question mm-hmm. concerning this is that does it necessarily have to be a Christian understanding of evil, or can it be a humanistic understanding of evil? Because I heard an interpretation that said that because Shakespeare, if Shakespeare emphasizes the choice of Macbeth in this process, then he distances himself from the medieval view and became a Renaissance man. So what did he say?
That's an interesting question. If we use the word humanist at that time, it means rather something rather different than today. Calvin is a humanist, one of the great humanists of that period, because he glories in an understanding of the arts and sciences. That's what a humanist means at that time. And I think in that sense, it's appropriate just to think of Shakespeare as a humanist, somebody who is deeply studied in the humanities. But he's certainly not a humanist. He's a humanist in that sense, like Sir Thomas More, or Calvin, or Erasmus. But he's certainly not a humanist in the 20th century sense of the word, as somebody who is living in a universe in which God is absent. It's certainly not possible, I think, to read Macbeth that way, though many productions of Shakespeare's plays do that. They read it, if you like, from a modernist perspective. But that perspective simply isn't present in the play. And if you're going to read it that way, then again, the witches become, either get back out, or they become a kind of joke, or they become a disease in his mind, rather than what they actually are, something genuinely occult in the play. And speeches like the one of Lady Macbeth that I read, spirits come and sex me here, have to be spoken as if they were coming from a diseased mind, rather than some kind of objective understanding of the reality of evil. But I don't think it's possible to read Shakespeare as a 20th century humanist. It simply isn't there. He certainly is a person who... it's one of the fascinating things one can do is to look at the huge number of references there are to the Bible. There are 3 volumes published, which one scholar has done. Christian himself on quotations from and allusions to biblical texts in the plays of Shakespeare. He uses several different versions of the Bible, including the Geneva Bible, Protestant Bibles, and also from the Anglican Prayer Book. There are many references to that as well. So he's a person who thoroughly familiar with the teaching church and with the teaching of God's Word and with the church's liturgy. And there are, in the plays altogether, there would be appropriate to say hundreds of references to the scriptures in the conversations of the people. So he's somebody who's thoroughly familiar with the Christian faith, and who nowhere takes a stand against it at all. In fact, just the opposite. So the other thing, at the personal level, he was a very good friend of John Donne, who was also a great poet, and eventually the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, and they would get together for a meal once a month with a group of friends. And Donne, at this point, is deeply passionate, becoming a Christian.
Was it at the time when Donne became committed?
Yes, in that time of his life, yes. Now, we don't know a great deal about Shakespeare's personal life, but I don't think there's any way one can read these plays and turn them into a 20th century humanist. Yes.
I have a question. You said somewhere in the beginning that there are many voices that are very strong and persuasive in his... Yes. And this is fascinating about his writings. I'm just wondering whether we can have this, or we can be accused of this Christian worldview more from our approach to his writings, rather than, because, you know, we tend to select all these Christian worldview voices and put them together. And maybe somebody else with a different worldview could select the other voices that are also strong. So how do we keep that in balance?
That's a great question. The first point I was making was simply this, that simply because he is such a good dramatist, every person, let's take a thoroughly evil person, someone who becomes evil, like Richard III, for example, or Titus Andronicus, or whoever it may be, speaks their position with extraordinary power. So he doesn't present any of his people half-heartedly, let's put it that way. They all come alive, putting forward the position that they hold, whether they are rebels against God or servants of God, whether they are people who think that life is a good or whatever it happens to be, they present their position very powerfully. And some of them are written in a setting where the characters could not possibly be Christian, say from ancient Greece or Rome, and they certainly don't, in that sense, present anything about the gospel. Quite obviously not. So they fit the moment in which they live in terms of the kinds of things about which they speak. Let's say Mark Antony speaking about honor, for example, and other things which were delighted in Rome at the time in which he lived. So he's faithful to his characters. That would be one way to put it. My point is this. There's a difference between that, somebody who has his characters speak with integrity to their place in history and to their parts in his plays, if you like, the characters they're playing. There's a difference between that and the worldview which pervades the plays altogether. And it's that that I'm suggesting. That at a much deeper level, as a kind of backdrop to the whole thing, there is a thoroughly Christian worldview. And one can see this all over the place. Now, in terms of the question you asked earlier, and I think this relates to it, is the view of evil, that's in fact, is it really a Christian view, or is it a humanist view? It is without question a Christian view. The view that he presents there, in terms of what I've called the many-pointed curse, the way evil comes about, and the consequences of evil, is radically different from the view in ancient Greek drama. I don't mean the view presented by one or two characters, but by the view that pervades, let's say, the plays of Aeschylus or Euripides or of Sophocles, where fate controls people, and it's quite clear, nobody would doubt it. I think the only reason why it's doubted at the moment in which we live is because as soon as you speak about Christianity, it's suspect in academic circles. But there is no reason whatsoever to doubt that Shakespeare is actually a Christian in terms of what he says. And it's at that level of the worldview that pervades everything he writes that I'm suggesting that this is a biblical worldview which is presented here. You won't find that approach to evil in anything else but a biblical worldview. It simply isn't there. It's not there in the ancient East. It's not there in the ancient Greco-Roman world. It's not there in the humanist world. It's not in the postmodern. It certainly isn't in the postmodern world. It simply isn't present. And he's not just simply being historically accurate in that sense when he presents Macbeth as somebody who's rebelling against God. It's at a deeper level of play, let's put it that way. That these are actual events that happen, that is, that nature is affected by human sin. That a ruler in authority destroys the whole nation which he rules over. But tyrants don't like to think that way. Many human societies don't think that way. But it's a very biblical view. It's at that level that Christianity pervades these plays. That Measure for Measure is another example. To write the kind of discussion of justice and mercy, of law and legalism, and redemption, that is all Measure for Measure is about, is impossible without a Christian understanding, because it simply doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. Precisely the same understanding of things. And so it's at that level I'm saying that this is a biblical worldview that's there. It's a good question. Thanks.
Yeah, I think I embrace your thesis here, and I think that's very good. And then I'm wondering, what can Christian artists learn from Shakespeare's example? In other words, can we see, did these plays speak to his generation in a way? I mean, or to the king or the queen or somebody? I mean, how did he see his ministry, if you will, as a Christian in the arts and
spoke to everybody. As I said, he performed his plays. He wrote some of them for the court, like Twelfth Night, which was originally written to be played on the Twelfth Night after Christmas, on the last night of their productions in front of the royal court. So some of them are written for that level, but all of his plays are written for every strata of society. And these were plays that were popular. The wealthy, the nobility, even the queen, the king went to see them, but so did the ordinary people. The theatre was, as you know, was built up on that, and many of the people watching were the seats for the wealthy, all the way around, and some of them on the stage, even on the stage. But they were also standing room, which cost very, very little. And so there are whole sections of his plays which are directed right to the ordinary people who were there standing in front watching. So a lot of the humor which is in them is there's something for everybody in these plays. So here's a man who wasn't writing for an elite, even though the elite watched them. He's writing for everybody, and these plays were seen by everybody, whether when they were performed in London, when they were performed in the provinces as they toured around. So this isn't a, and I think that's one of the lessons for any Christian working in the arts anywhere. But who am I doing this for? Do I really wish to serve everybody? And he's clearly somebody who did. And that's true right up till today. His plays are enjoyed by anybody. They're good plays, and that's why people all over the world can see them, and they can be translated so readily into other languages and into other cultures without any problem whatsoever, because he's dealing with perennial human issues, things which never change, which are common to the human condition everywhere. That's one thing I think we learn. I think for any writer, So Shakespeare has an extraordinary delight in words, and the power of words, the music of words, which anybody who has any pretensions to be a writer at all, there is no better master in the English language to learn from than somebody who understands the music of words so well. There are many things, I think, that any Christian artist can learn, because he is a master in terms of what he's doing.
Sorry, I'll just build on the same subject, if I may.
Okay.
Thank you.
Jim, it seems to me, I mean, this conference is clearly concerned about how we speak Christianity into Europe.
Yes.
And what you've just said there about artists, it seems to me that there's an enormously neglected area in Christian ministry in terms of our treasuring words and working at words and using words. We believe that the word has come among us, and yet our sermons are often ill-scripted, they are verbally impoverished, we have limited vocabularies, and no one in the Christian world that I'm aware of seems to write about this. And yet the most effective Christian communicators have been very gifted with words.
Like C.S. Lewis.
Yeah. C.S. Lewis and John Stott in a sort of classical way, Francis Schaeffer in a more inventive way. He would use words in an arresting way, which you would stop and have to, you know, the mannishness of man, or the sort of the devilish din. And phrases that would take you, would stop you in your track, and you'd read them over. It seems to me this is an area that is very neglected in the evangelical world.
No, you're right, it is indeed. And I think one of the fascinating things, I'm going to talk about it a bit tomorrow when I talk about Tolkien, is one of the fascinating things to me, and I think this is one of the other things that Shakespeare is encouraging on for any Christians working in the arts, as well as his recognition of the power of words and the devotion to doing that well. The greatest preacher in his time was John Donne, who also was somebody who was had a wonderful way with words. Now, he was supposed to be the best preacher in England at the time, and you read his sermons today and they're just magnificent. We still have phrases from them in our language. From the sermons that Donne preached at this time when Shakespeare is flourishing. But if we think of the example of somebody like Shakespeare or Tolkien, yesterday I was talking about Jane Austen, all three of these basically did something thoroughly new. They weren't afraid as Christians to take the particular form in which they worked and do something which was radically new. This is true with Shakespeare, who takes drama in the English language to a completely new level in terms of the kind of subject matter with which he's dealing with it, the things that he does on the stage. He takes drama out of it being controlled by the conventions which had come down from the Greeks right until his time. He's doing all sorts of things in a radically new way. Just as Tolkien did. I mean, Tolkien's really writing the first fantasy as a Christian. And I'll talk about that tomorrow. I think your question is a very good one, because when Christians communicate well, really work hard at the gifts that God has given them, and then use means that are there to communicate to the society, and are prepared to do things that are new, very challenging, and God uses them in extraordinary ways. There aren't many writers more popular than Tolkien at the moment. C.S. Lewis, of course, is another example of, and he's going to become even more popular when the films start coming out next year that they're making, of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and the other children's books. And his book sales will start going even higher. Which is a wonderful thing. And this is simply because these people were great artists, great writers. And as I said earlier,
Shakespeare is certainly the greatest dramatist, certainly the most widely seen that has ever written plays in any language, and has an extraordinary impact on people, and I think causes human beings to think about very serious issues over and over and over and over again. You can't see a play like Measure for Measure or Hamlet or Macbeth without reflecting on the human condition. The plays are very, very challenging to the people who watch them. They're not simply entertainment. There's some very powerful things being communicated. They are entertainment, and Shakespeare is an entertainer, a supremely good one. But there's always more going on than that. Just like Lewis is a great storyteller, but there's always more, and Tolkien is a great storyteller, but there's always more. There's both entertainment and things to stretch people all over the place. And that,
it's actually the way that words hold attention. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had great stories and picked up and developed great stories, but of course it was the way he verbalized them that left people stunned. And no one in the Christian world seems to be... I mean, you go to seminars on preaching and no one talks about that. Mm-hmm. And we wonder why people don't hear us. It's because we're dull and because we're not creative and we don't describe adequately the sort of colossal message we've got to get across. Mm.
Dorothy Sayers wrote some wonderful things about it. Yeah. About the necessity of regarding our creeds and the message we proclaim as something which is the most extraordinary story that the world has ever seen. And she wrote some wonderful things about it, and a few other people have addressed it, but I think you're right in the criticism that very often preachers think far too lowly of the calling that we're given to present the Word made flesh in a way that has some life to it. Let's put it that way.
I've read Eugene Peterson say that the preacher's task, main task, is to redeem words. Mm. And I thought that
is to
redeem words.
He's written some wonderful things about it. That's a very good example, Eugene Peterson, both about worship and about words and about pastoring. He's written some really wonderful books. Mm. I really would encourage you to read him. I use his books all the time when I teach pastoral theology at Covenant because he's written some of the best things that I'm aware of on the calling of the pastor.
Yeah. I try to persuade John Stott to write about his use of words. Mm. You almost kind of see that there's an issue, and yet clearly, subconsciously or consciously, when he has written the sermons, he has been most creative in his expression. I used as a student to wait to listen to his summaries at the end of his sermons, in particular, because he would summarize them using completely different words and phrases than he'd use in, has he made that point? Why don't you think about the whole thing again? Because it was expressed completely freshly.
Somebody else who's written well about it is my colleague and president of Covenant, Brian Chappell, who's a very fine preacher, one of the best preachers I ever get to hear. And he's written some about this too. He's got several books of his sermons that you can get, but you might look out for him and Eugene Peterson. I think those are both people who've written about this issue.
Last year, my brother and I went to Kolozsvár in Cluj in Transylvania, Romania, mm-hmm. and I think you know Vishke András.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and he took us to the theater, mm-hmm. and they were playing Hamlet, mm-hmm. in Romanian, and we don't speak Romanian.
Yeah.
And it was directed by Vlad Mogur, the Romanian director, and he put it in a modern context. So Hamlet became, when he became he played the idiot, he was a punk, mm-hmm. and a rebellious young person. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting to see this play in a way that we did not understand the words. Mm-hmm. And it was so violent. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was the, because it was staged, put into stage that way. So like Hamlet was almost raping Ophelia on the stage, and we didn't understand the words, so we just saw the what was going on, people shouting, and so I was thinking that is it that because of the words and the beauty of the words of Shakespeare that I don't see the violence in the original, or is it really violent in the original, and evil should be
that's interesting
really there.
Hamlet itself has patches of violence, primarily at the very end, of course, with the sword fight and the killings there and the poisoning. But the play as a whole is not full of violence. But it isn't simply the words, because I've seen productions in English which have dealt absurdly with the plays. I took my mother, when she was married for the second time, her second husband was supposed to, he'd never read a book in his life, and my mother loved books and she loved the theatre. So for 24 years, it wasn't possible to go until he died. And a couple of years after his death, we were visiting her and we took her to Stratford in England, and I called just to check on the production. It was A Midsummer Night's Dream, and I thought, no problems, but I'll check for sure. And I called them and I asked about it, and they said, oh yes, this is a play that would be entirely suitable even for small children. So I thought, well, maybe they've tried to actually deal with the text as it is. But I got there and it was absolutely abominable. My mother, who was no prude, was shocked to the core. One of the scene between Bottom and the Fairy Queen was bestial, to say the least. And it was just absolutely appalling. And the whole play was like that. It was a gross misrepresentation of what Shakespeare had done. And in many ways, it was completely, it was a postmodern production. Completely. And it was absolutely shocking.
We took this into our ownership of that. Exactly the same with the first Shakespeare we were talking to. Unfortunately, she was 6, and I think it just went past.
We thought afterwards, thank heaven she wasn't 12 or 13, you know, because it just went across her. I know the one you made. It was shockingly misrepresented.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the most innocent of Shakespeare's plays, but it was the most shocking production of anything I've ever seen. Yeah, it was just awful. I just felt so badly for my mother, because she was so delighted about this occasion. She hadn't been to the theatre for 25 years, and finally we got to go and got this travesty of Shakespeare's play, which had nothing whatsoever to do with it. And it was presented as a kind of conflict between a kind of rigid Puritanism of the court, of the human court, and then the kind of sensual glory of nature in the fairies. I mean, that was basically what the play was turned into. Well, that's not what it is when you read it. I mean, there's no way you could read that into the text. And it was an extraordinary imposition on the text. And one can see productions like that, which do things to the text which simply aren't there. And what then happens is the words themselves that Shakespeare wrote work against the visual spectacle which you're seeing, and that was true in that production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I've seen productions of Hamlet like that, where the words themselves are constantly working against what the director has done with this material. And I've seen productions of Macbeth which have been the same. And it creates a tremendous tension in the audience, because you know, if you actually pay attention to the words rather than just watching the spectacle, you realize that there's something deeply amiss here. And it doesn't take a Christian to see this, but there is this tension between the two things. But yeah, people will do anything, will do anything at all. Now, having said that, there are some really wonderful productions
And some of those that are set in completely contemporary situations can be excellent. The version of Romeo and Juliet, which is set in Los Angeles among gangs, is an entirely appropriate place to set it, along with Leonardo DiCaprio. And that's pretty faithful to the story in terms of the way it presents what's going on. So there's no problem taking it out of its historical and cultural setting and sticking it in another one. Kenneth Branagh does that with his production of Hamlet. You know, it's stuck in the 18th century somewhere, early 19th century, maybe late 19th century perhaps. And I suppose you think about the uniforms they were wearing, but that doesn't matter in the slightest. So it's not when they put it or what the people are wearing or things like that. It's the interpretation of the play at a deeper level which creates the problems. We should probably stop there. I think we're just about out of time, so I don't know what the time is, but yeah, we are. It's 5:40, so we're 10 minutes over here. So thank you for your questions.
Thank you.
You're supposed to fill out some evaluations. Thanks. Do I have a favorite? Well, really, whatever one I'm reading or watching at the moment. But I guess, actually, I really like Hamlet. I think it's an extraordinary play.
Nine Lines of the Tempest.
Yes.
It's like a diamond, it just turns so many ways.
But then I really like Macbeth, too. I think Much Ado About Nothing, that film version, was so absolutely delightful. I must have seen that a dozen times, and it's just a joy every time you see it. Yes. Yes. That's fascinating. You saw that production.
Yes, 7 or 8 years.